Hello, and welcome to the DMV Business Show, a weekly show where we get to meet local business and community leaders in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area. They get to impact their story and how they got there. You can expect to hear advice and learn about their journey and how they went from point A to point B. My name is Otto Sevilla, and I'm a commercial real estate advisor in the local DC, Maryland, and Northern Virginia area. I have been very fortunate to have worked with many amazing entrepreneurs and executives, from startup founders to international Fortune 500 companies. And one of the things I love about what I do is I get to form these great relationships with some interesting people. I get to know them and I learn about how it all started. And I love hearing a good business story. When I'm not working in commercial real estate, I just also happen to be the host of this show. So please enjoy and welcome to the DMV Business Show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the DMV Business Show. I'm your host, Otto Sevilla. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Colin Tarbert. Colin is the president and CEO of the BDC. In case of you who do not know, what is BDC is the Baltimore Development Corporation. And they're doing some amazing things in Baltimore City, which we're going to go into later. But welcome to the show, Colin. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course. As I mentioned offline before we started recording, I like the audience to get to know the individual a little better, how they are as a human. Are you from around the Maryland area, or where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I'm local. I grew up just outside of Baltimore City in the Parkville, Towson area of Baltimore County. But my family grew up in the city and still have a lot of family members living in the city as well. So definitely grew up locally and didn't travel too far from home for college. Went to College Park, University of Maryland, just down the road.
Oh, so you're also a Terp alumni.
I am a Terp.
Oh, that's great. Okay, that makes two of us. Yeah. So you said you grew up outside of the city, around what city or town?
Well, I grew up just outside of Baltimore City.
Okay.
So I grew up in Towson, Parkville area, which is
Towson.
Just over the line.
Okay. How were you growing up as a child? What were you into? Do you remember?
Do I remember? It was a while ago at this point, but lots of activities. You know, I was, I'm not known for my sports or athleticism. So there's a lot of jokes running around at BDC. If you want to have small talk, don't ask me what the latest score was, because I won't know. But as a kid, I did a lot of scouting when I was younger. So definitely into Boy Scouts, camping, outdoors activities. Did a little bit of baseball, but then in high school, I mostly focused on my aspiring rock career. Played a little bit of guitar in some local bands. Nothing good at all, but had a lot of fun. And so that was mainly what I focused on in high school, is hanging out with the music crowd and bands, and playing in the city, playing some shows in Fells Point when I was in college, and then really got kind of focused on architecture as I entered into my college years.
Interesting. When you mentioned band, what was your instrument of choice?
I play guitar, so electric guitar, acoustic guitar. Yeah.
What made you go into that? Were you looking to get girls' attention back then?
Probably. It didn't work, I could tell you that. But no, it was fun. Actually, my dad was a great guitar player, so he passed away a few years ago. But he played guitar, and so I picked it up from him, and we always had nice choice instruments at the house. And then just in high school, most of my friends were all in bands, and that's kind of what we did.
That's nice. You mentioned the scouts there. Did you start as a Cub Scout?
I started as a Cub Scout. I think there was something called Weeblos as well, and then went all the way through and became Eagle Scout. Just shy of my 18th birthday. For those of you who are in scouting, you have to make Eagle, which is the highest rank, before you become officially an adult. So a lot of us, you know, hurry up and undertake what's called an Eagle Scout project in order to make all of the different requirements. So did that. My brother, I have an older brother as well, who is also in the scouting and the Eagle Scout. So definitely followed in his footsteps.
My oldest son, I put him in the Cub Scouts. We pulled him out when COVID started, but it's definitely a great organization and what they do there and all the different activities.
Yeah, I have a daughter now, but now you can be a girl and join the Boy Scouts. So
Yes, that's true.
we'll see if she wants. She's only three, but we'll see if she wants to do that maybe in a few years.
Do you think I hear it's different compared to the boys and the girls? I have all boys, so I'm not sure as far as the with the Girl Scouts. Besides them selling cookies, and I love those cookies.
They're very good cookies. My wife still supports the Girl Scouts by buying those cookies, and I support by eating them. But I don't know. I wasn't. I didn't. I only have a brother, so we didn't interact too much with the Girl Scouts. I'm not sure how different Boy Scouts is from Girl Scouts, but I think there's a lot of similar overlap, it seemed like.
Yeah. So you said in high school you were into band and a musician and all that. And then after high school, you mentioned you said you also went to College Park or University of Maryland, right?
I did, yeah. So went to University of Maryland and studied. I lived on campus, which was great. So I had the experience of the big campus, but also being close to home. So as I mentioned, I was coming home actually a lot on the weekends because my friends were still living in Baltimore. I had a few friends that from high school who went to College Park with me, and they were in band, so we were traveling back up to Baltimore and around to play shows and have fun. But I was focused on my studies. I didn't deviate too much from academics, and focused on architecture. Applied early decision actually to go into architecture. Had a little bit of experience, with art and building some things. Kind of always enjoyed that. And so took up architecture as an undergraduate, went all the way through that program, which is a great program. Although, you're at University of Maryland, there's 10,000 students. The architecture program, when I graduated, we had a little over 40 people in our class. So you get a really small school experience with the big university feel, and really enjoyed it, and ended up staying at Maryland, and did my master's degree in architecture as well, and then graduated and never practiced. But that's more to that story as we go on.
Why did you decide to go into architecture?
I'm not really sure specifically. It was just I'd started like building some things in high school. I also participated in the drama club, but I was on the tech side of it. So we did a lot of the building of the scenery and the stage. And then I was always sort of working on, little mini projects around the house. And a family friend was a contractor who I ended up working for over a couple summers doing outdoor deck and building and that sort of thing. So yeah, it just seemed like a good blend of art and skill set. And my mother was pretty much adamant that I wasn't gonna do music as a career. She thought that was too risky and too wild. So architecture seemed like a pretty good balance of doing something that was art, but also professional in terms of advancement.
And pretty much for architecture, you need it's not a must, but you definitely need that master's. I remember I'm commercial real estate. We had an intern who had an undergrad in architecture as well from College Park, and he didn't pursue the master's. He was unsure whether he wanted to do that or not. But pretty much if you want to work in the field of the master is a must, right?
Yeah, I think if you want to get, to be a licensed architect, you have to have at least a 5-year degree. So there's a Bachelor of Architecture degree, which is offered at some universities, which is called the 5-year plan. And then there's the 4-and-2 plan, which is the undergraduate and the master's degree, which is the master's degree is 2 years, if you have an undergraduate degree. So yeah, it's a lot of an undertaking, if you really want to do it and pursue it and get licensed and practice. I didn't have enough, I guess, patience for it. And so ended up getting much more interested in real estate, as did you, and going a little bit of a different route in my career. But I still draw on a lot of the things I learned in architecture school, both design wise and then just critical thinking skills. It wasn't the typical degree program. There's not a fixed solution for architecture. You have to, come up with unique solutions and explain them, and win over your professors that you've given it a lot of thought and energy.
Did you also, for the master's program, you also stayed in Maryland?
Yeah, I went to University of Maryland for both. So
okay. Okay.
It was like one long 6-year degree is really kind of what the experience was. But I was very fortunate. I studied very well in my undergraduate and graduated, you know, pretty high in my class. And Maryland offers, I don't know if they still offer it, but at the time, if you had a certain GPA, you could pretty much get your full tuition paid for your first year of graduate school. So between that and some graduate assistance, I basically got my graduate degree covered and came out debt free, which was great.
That is great. So once you received the master's, you decided not to go into that, or what happened then as far as not continuing with that architect field?
Yeah, so in architecture school, for those of you who have been, you know that you spend a lot of time in what they call studio. So instead of doing your work in your dorm room, you end up spending a lot of time at the architecture building, and you have a desk and you spend late nights there, all-nighters as they're called. And there's quite a few of those in architecture. And so when you're doing that, you're also usually talking to your neighbors. Occasionally there might be an adult beverage involved in that. And you kind of end up just like, if you don't have your headphones on and you're in it, which is also part of the time, you're usually debating and having intellectual conversations with your colleagues, which was a great part of architecture school. So I guess I was running my mouth a little too much about politics and government and these things, which I didn't really even know I was doing at the time. And I was also very curious, as most college kids are. And so while I was at University of Maryland, I took extra classes outside of architecture, which is a little unusual, and it's very hard to do because the undergraduate program at Maryland, you spend the last 2 years, so your junior and senior year in studio, but your first 2 years, you don't. It's different for other schools where you spend 4 years in studio, but sort of less time. So the first 2 years of the program, you have sort of more leeway to sort of explore and take other subjects that you're interested in. And then like the last 2 years, you're pretty much just stuck in studio. So I say that by background because I was able to take an entrepreneurship program. It was actually kind of like the first year that they did it at University of Maryland. It's obviously still in existence today. And so I did the citation program at the business school. And that gave me a lot of exposure to business and entrepreneurship. And then in undergrad and definitely in grad school, I also took some urban planning classes, which is also part of the architecture school. But the planners and the architects didn't really talk to each other. We were kind of on different paths and different schedules. And of course, the business school students didn't talk to the architecture students because we were, a sidewalk apart, which is, must have been 10 miles. And so I crossed the sidewalk and went there and I met some of the planners. And so what was great about that was, they kind of, I got some good advice. And so one of the planners had done what's called a fellowship at the city, Baltimore City government. And so by the year after my undergraduate, the year after my master's degree, I apologize, it's been so long. I took part in a Baltimore City fellowship program. And so it was Mayor O'Malley at the time. I applied, I was accepted, and I was placed, they place you at a different agency based on your skill set and what you want to learn. And so I was placed here at Baltimore Development Corporation, in 2006, I guess it was, so many moons ago, and basically started here as an intern. And that came out of those late night debates in studio about, any kind of, politics or whatever. Government. And so I never thought I would be in government. I was always wanted to be a real estate tycoon like yourself, an entrepreneur. And that was sort of what got me interested in real estate development and ultimately, led to me being here at Baltimore Development Corporation.
Wow, that was 15 years ago, Colin. That's great. Okay. But you're still a young guy. It's never too late.
Yeah, I haven't ruled it out yet. So maybe after my public service, I'll go and be a real estate developer. But it's not as easy as people think. Obviously, we work with a lot of real estate developers here, and I've been part of lots of projects on the public side, and even have played a little bit of real estate developer here in my public service, which we can talk about if we get to public markets. But yeah, not for the faint of heart. There's a lot of money at risk and a lot of things can go wrong. And so, you know, oftentimes it looks easy and people say, oh, the developers are making all this money, but you can lose a lot of money. And we saw that in 2008 when I was here as a staff person.
Yeah. Colin, the BDC, for those who may not know, I mean, you guys have so many resources there. You mentioned real estate to tax incentives to different initiatives and programs for local small businesses in the city. Can you explain just a general overview to the audience what the BDC is, please?
Sure. So technically, we're the City of Baltimore Development Corporation. We're an independent 501c3 charitable organization. It's set up like that. In the late 80s, but we function as the city's economic development agency. So our sole, you know, mission here is to expand the job base and the tax base in Baltimore City. And now we're starting to, you know, craft a more refined version of that. But at a high level, like, that's what we want. We want jobs, we want taxes, we want growth. And so we have lots of different sort of programs and services that we offer, which I can go through. But at a high level, you know, we work with everyone from an entrepreneur all the way to, you know, a company the size of Amazon and everyone in between. And, you know, a large portion of that is working directly with companies who are typically here, where retention is always sort of the first strategy. It's sort of the easiest one, you know, let's keep what we have. And then two is expanding those businesses. So hopefully they're being successful and growing. And so we want to make sure that they have the space and the talent to do that. And then third is, you know, attracting and new companies to come here and making sure that they're welcome and that they get through all the processes that you need to get through to start a company. So we do a tremendous amount of, you know, business development. And then, you know, the other portion is focused on, you know, assisting or in some cases initiating real estate projects. More lately in the BDC history, it's more working with developers to get, you know, private development underway. But we also have a lot of city property that we control and oversee that we're trying to get, you know, put into, you know, higher and better uses.
Great. Before your current role right now as the president and CEO of the BDC, you said you started off as an intern 15 or so years ago, right?
Correct. Yeah.
How was that transition from intern 15 years ago to where you are now in your current role?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it, you know, happened. It feels like it happened yesterday. It feels like forever ago. So it's sort of a, you know, interesting position, but yeah, I mean, it was great. It gives me a lot of perspective. So because I, you know, started here essentially as an intern, and then I worked here for 4 years after a brief stint in the private sector. I worked here for 4 years as a staff person, you know, doing the day-to-day work. You know, I have a good understanding of what my team is doing and the hard work that it is to move it forward. So that's great for being now in sort of the leadership position because I've been there, right? So people can't accuse me of not having, you know, climbed the ladder. I did that. I also spent, you know, after I was here at BDC, I spent about 9 years in the mayor's office in different roles. And a lot of it was sort of working with BDC and in some ways, you know, BDC reporting to the mayor through me. So, you know, I know this agency very well, served on the board for, you know, 5+ years before I came back. It was always, you know, working with BDC to get their projects through and, you know, any city approvals or partnerships they needed, you know, in the mayor's office, that was my role. But that the mayor's office role, of course, gives you a much broader perspective than just having worked at BDC. And so that has also been instrumental to understand how people on the outside view BDC, but also having this, you know, long and in-depth understanding of what it's like to be inside BDC. And so I'm trying to, you know, work those two things at the same time to, you know, further us. We're a good organization. I think we have a very good reputation in terms of our professionalism and what we're able to deliver. But there's also, you know, issues around equity and who BDC is serving and what is the city's, you know, future economic or economy look like, and you know, what does that mean, and how's BDC, what's BDC's role in that? And so that's really where I am today in terms of trying to take everything I've learned over the last 15 years and, you know, hopefully craft the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of both Baltimore's economy, but then also, you know, what's BDC's role in that, and how can we play not a more positive role, but just sort of a more, I think, defined role in inclusivity and equity, and making sure that people who haven't been able to participate in the city's economy or feel like BDC is not someone, or BDC doesn't serve them, making sure that they, they're heard and that they're part of our future, and that BDC is working with those folks as well.
Is that one of the recent purposes why you launched Baltimore Together?
Yeah, so thanks for bringing up Baltimore Together. And this is every 5 years, roughly, the city and other cities and regions go through a strategic planning process. So the acronym in sort of trade language is SEDS. It's a comprehensive economic development strategy that's required by the federal government in order to be eligible for certain federal economic development funds. That said, the timing of it, when I began as president and CEO at BDC about a year and a half ago, we were coming up on that 5 year timeline. And so I took the opportunity not just to, you know, do a strategic plan for the federal government, but really to kind of take a step back and create what we hope to be a, you know, a whole comprehensive vision for, you know, Baltimore, who we are, who we want to be in terms of economic development, that guides both BDC in terms of the work that we're doing here in a more sort of mission-driven way, but also brings as many partners to the table as possible to be part of, you know, Baltimore's future. It's not something that, that BDC is going to do by ourselves. It's not something that just the mayor can do by himself, but really kind of bringing together all the public, private, and nonprofit partners around one very concrete vision for where we want to drive our economic future. And so that is Baltimore Together. And that's really what we're aiming to do. It's a fairly large task, a big vision, and it's going to take, you know, several years to get pulled together and really begin to be implemented. But it's something I think we have to do. It's something that's imperative for our future. We haven't, like, we, the last 5 year plan we did, you know, was good, but I don't think it ever sort of got the gravitas that we really need to bring everyone together, which of course is the title, to sort of drive our future in a very intentional way.
What do you think is some of the major differences between this plan compared to the one you had previously?
So I think the one, I think we're building off of the one we did previously, of course. A lot of the growth sectors that we're focused on haven't changed, because they don't, you know, change in a short period of time. 5 years is a short period of time in terms of economic development. But where this one goes is, it's one, it's very intentional around inclusive economic growth. And so Mayor Scott, you know, talks a lot about equity. And so we're beginning to define, well, what does that mean in terms of economic development? So we launched a website that folks can go to, baltimoretogether.com. You can sign up for information to stay in the loop and participate in crafting the final version of the document, which we hope will happen late spring, early summer. But what you'll find on there is an interim report, which talks about the year plus work that we've done with almost 300 people now, and kind of crafting some overarching strategies, you know, that ultimately will be defined in the final plan. But we talk a lot about inclusive, we talk about equity, and there's a very specific commitment to racial equity in the beginning of this plan, which, you know, not only is BDC not sort of written a very declarative statement on, you know, closing the racial inequities in the city, but even as a city, we haven't sort of had this declared statement. So that's a one major difference, and you'll see that right up front. Two, you know, we're just trying to engage a lot more people in this process. And three, we're making it a 5 year initiative. So while the last plan was sort of looking out 5 years, this one is really an implementation plan. And the goal by the time we finish this is to have a framework and a structure hopefully with someone leading just Baltimore together, to be able to implement this and report out on an annual, if not more frequent basis, like the work that's getting done. And so this will be much more of a living initiative as opposed to a, you know, a booklet that sits on a shelf, you know, so to speak. And so those are some of the main differences that, that Baltimore Together has versus, you know, what we've done in the past.
I noticed in this report, Colin, that there is a big focus on bringing more people in to the city to be here as residents. And that's great considering that historically, the last years, Baltimore City has been losing people, right? I like that part a lot. Is there, what are the city's thoughts or how do they plan to actually do that as far as bringing in more residents into the city?
Yeah, what you'll find on the website is you'll find a pretty in-depth report there about growth in terms of residential growth and what that means in terms of the economy. And the short version, for those that don't want to read the 80 plus pages, is that, you know, Baltimore needs residents and we need all types of residents. So it's very much, again, aligned with our inclusive growth policy. We don't care if you're making $1 million or you're making minimum wage. You know, having you as a resident of Baltimore City is going to help our economy move forward. And so we're welcoming everybody who wants to be part of this city's future. So how do we do that? I mean, that's sort of the big question, right? I think we've got to try to figure out everything. There's a lot of reasons to move to Baltimore. And actually, I think post-pandemic, we may see those trends in Baltimore's favor. As you mentioned, people are moving out of the city faster than they're moving in. So we have a net migration out. However, if you look at the data, and some of this, again, is if you click through the website, you'll find some of the data about who is moving in. And so what we see is we actually see higher educated or more educated individuals with higher wages moving into the city. The folks leaving the city are either lower income people or middle class, in particular, middle class African-American families who I think have reached a level of success and decide they're going to move out to the suburbs for you know, quality of life issues, for housing type, et cetera. So one, again, is a retention strategy. Same thing with business development. It's easier to, you know, keep who you have here. So one is trying to address, in this case, it's almost black flight from the city, figure out why those families are leaving and what we could do to keep them in the city. And then two is, you know, continuing to promote Baltimore as a place to live for those who are outside of the city. What we're seeing is we need demand for new housing. And so there's an accompanying report that our partner agency did, which is Live Baltimore. They're also a nonprofit, partly city funded, and they're focused completely on residential growth and residential retention. And so they did a market study, and depending on like the type of housing, we believe that there's a lot of growth opportunity. So, you know, homes that have that are more appropriate for growing families is one. You know, here we have a lot of apartments. They're doing well. A lot of the neighborhoods in some of the denser areas of the city, Canton, Fells Point. I live in Butchers Hill, which is, you know, also a row house community. We have three floors, so it's a little bit bigger. But when you have a growing family, you know, and you start to look at options, you know, you tend to look at larger, maybe more suburban type housing. And so folks leave and they move to the suburbs. But of course, we have a lot of the older suburbs in the city as well. So I think, you know, targeted incentive programs make a lot of sense to keep those. It's much easier to incentivize existing residents for a few $1,000 to keep them here. The city will do much better long term than having them leave and trying to recapture them. We need to focus on our, you know, property tax issue. It's very high compared to the surrounding counties. Just the cost of living can be more expensive, even though our housing costs tend to be a lot more affordable. And so some of those things are talked about in the report, and they're talked about in the work that Live Baltimore has done. But a lot of it's also just knowledge. You know, people sort of assume that the city school system, you know, isn't great for their family, but they actually don't know that when they get into it and we introduce them to the principles. they're a lot more open-minded about schools and that sort of thing. So I think it's marketing. I think it's telling our story. I think there are some competitive competitive issues that we need to focus on in terms of incentives, our property tax, and then just the type of housing, making sure that we're offering everything that the market's demanding.
You know, I love this area. There's not many areas in the country, I believe, that are strategically located and have two major cities, two major MSAs, 45 an hour drive. You have Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. I grew up in D.C. and now live in Maryland now for several years. But I love Baltimore because it gave me that first opportunity as a real estate investor myself. And I purchased my first multifamily in Baltimore City. And like you said, you see it firsthand with the demographics in the city and the population that you said is net migrating, but there's still demand. I even remember some of our first few tenants were some MICA students, because it was near sort of the Station North area there. But I think there's just tremendous potential in the city.
Yeah, we have amazing locations. So, you know, being part of the DMV is a huge asset for us. You can jump on a train and be in New York in 2.5 hours. You can jump on a train and be in DC in, 45 minutes. And sort of Baltimore is this, in some ways, this sort of undiscovered gem, which in some ways is great for me because I think I have, a pretty easy pitch once we get people here to Baltimore. Same, it's also so frustrating because it's like, we should be growing, not even shrinking, yet the census numbers that are going to come out, I'm sure, are going to show us declining again in population. But when you start to look at who's moving in, who's moving out, that tells a different story about, I think, where our future is headed, as opposed to maybe the current numbers. And I know when I bring people here, from out of town, or we see site selectors who come in and haven't been here for 20 years, they're blown away with the amount of progress that's happened. Not just, around the waterfront when people see Harbor East and they see the Four Seasons, but neighborhoods like Station North, where BDC started, 10 plus years ago, making strategic acquisitions and making strategic investments. They've blossomed into the really cool, authentic arts districts with a whole mix of people, extremely diverse. You mentioned colleges and universities. We've got 16 colleges and universities in the surrounding area. I think most, if not, about 12 or 13 of them are in the city proper. So you have this, annual, influx of young, obviously intelligent people coming to Baltimore and learning about it. So. So we have so much here to offer, from geography to talent to affordability. And, as I mentioned, we're seeing people moving from Silicon Valley, San Francisco, New York, even DC, right? You can take the train, you can still work in DC, but live in Baltimore, and Philadelphia too. I mean, Philadelphia is very similar to Baltimore, but I think from an affordability standpoint, I think Baltimore still definitely edges out in terms of competition. So I think the future is bright for Baltimore. We have a lot here to celebrate. We're this undiscovered gem that, it's kind of nice to keep it to ourselves, but at the same time, I think for us to, kind of continue to see more neighborhoods transform the way Station North has, we want to bring more people to the city.
Yeah, no, that's great. What would you say, Colin, as an individual that drives you and motivates you?
I think I've just always been interested in giving 100% of whatever I do. I guess my rock star career didn't quite pan out, I've always just been passionate about cities. I sort of left out part of the story about also how I ended up in Baltimore. When I graduated undergrad at Maryland and I was doing architecture, I'd gotten all the scholarship money. I sort of joked, I said, I got all the scholarship money that Maryland's going to get me. And I'm not going on for a PhD. So grades aren't as important to me anymore in grad school. And I really wanted to do something that was more meaningful than just getting, a 4.0. And so, I started doing a lot of volunteer work for Habitat for Humanity. And I was doing volunteer work. University of Maryland had a chapter in Sandtown, which is in West Baltimore. And so, you know, my band days had kind of gone away. So I wasn't coming up here to Baltimore to play gigs, but I was coming up here basically every weekend to build houses in West Baltimore, which was a really fun experience. And I ended up sort of doing my thesis work more on community development, which again sort of led me into this government career after my internship, which I did, you know, after doing my thesis. Again, that kind of like led me to the city, the role of city government in transforming neighborhoods and economic issues and whatnot. And so, you know, I sort of do everything like 100%. So I might not do a lot, but when I do it, I try to go all in. So when I was doing architecture, you know, I was up here every weekend. It became partly my social life as well as, you know, sort of the academic undertaking. And so I think that's still what drives me today. You know, I don't have that many interests outside of doing this. This is what I like to do. I just happen to get paid for it, which is awesome as well. But I'm just, you know, a city enthusiast. I love traveling. I love working with other cities. That's sort of one thing that I'm taking on here at BDC. I was on a call this morning with my counterparts in Italy, in particular in Torino, Italy, Turin, Northern Italy, that we've been building a relationship with over the last couple of years. And people are like, what is this about? You know, Italy and Turin, you just want to go on trips. I said, yeah, of course I want to go on trips and go to Italy. It's so exciting. But the amount of work that they're doing in social innovation, and they're a very similar city to Baltimore. They lost a third of their population. They're post-industrial. They're trying to find their next, you know, sort of place in Italy's economy. And so, you know, again, like, it's fun. I really enjoy the benefits of, you know, going to Italy and dining and having fun food and wine, but it's really just like part of my career path. And so I've just been able to kind of blend those. So what drives me is really just sort of like my passion for the work that I get to do. And for me, it's both fun and a career at the same time.
That's so interesting, Colin. So you mentioned Italy. So you're there, obviously, I'm assuming, watching what they're doing and what you can possibly incorporate here in Baltimore, right?
Yeah, and actually, like, even further from that, like, we had a company that graduated from Conscious Venture Labs, which is run by Jeff Carey. They're here in West Baltimore. Actually, they just moved their offices to Port Covington. But one of Jeff's startup companies ended up in Turin at doing Techstars Mobility. So there's real connection. So it's not just about, you know, Baltimore and Turin having this relationship, but it's really about a global economy. And in Baltimore, as you'll see in the, you know, Baltimore Together report, we're very much focused on, you know, just aligning our own city, trying to get our own partners lined up. But that's like a frankly, that's like a baby step. Like, we have to do that. We have to all be partners together. But where I want us to move to, and we got to move there quickly, is like, where's Baltimore on the global stage? You know, we talk a lot about being East Coast city, but, like, you know, we're an American city. We're a global city. We have a port that does, you know, number one in roll-on, roll-off cargo in the world, or at least in the United States. But obviously, that's a worldwide logistics hub. And so, you know, the relationship with Turin is just sort of emblematic of where I want us to go in terms of our aspiration. Like, let's be a world leader. And we can do that. We've got Johns Hopkins here. We've got University of Maryland. One of the things that we call out in Baltimore Together, where I think we have a real opportunity that is a new kind of growing sector in Baltimore, is social innovation. And so we've got some great leaders, Lali DeRaza at Fearless, who has a great software tech company, but he's also doing Hack Baltimore, and they just opened up Hutch, which is a kind of accelerator for social entrepreneurship. We've got Innovation Works. I mentioned Jeff Cherry and Conscious Venture Labs. The list goes on. And so I think that's an opportunity for Baltimore to really shine. And that's sort of one of the exchanges that we're doing in particular with Torino. But, you know, again, like, we should be shooting for being Baltimore, you know, worldwide, not just, you know, competing with D.C. or our neighboring counties.
I love that you mentioned, as far as a social impact and innovation and tech there, you also have there at the BDC, the ETC, the Emergent Technology Center, right?
Correct. So ETC for short, Emerging Technology Centers, started almost like over 20 years ago. and was one of the first kind of tech incubators in the country, and got this great legacy. Ironically, there's a, I don't know the name of it, and there's probably a bunch, but there's rankings for, you know, the number one incubator in the world. And we were number two. ETC was ranked number two last year. Turin was ranked number one, which we kind of joked about. Again, these kind of strange connections that come up. But yeah, ETC is great. I mean, we have graduates of that program that have gone on. So, you know, some of our rock stars was Millennial Media, which just got, you know, bought by AOL, which bought Groupon. But Millennial Media was one of those companies. The list goes on in terms of ETC graduates. And so we operate that tech center. It's an instrument of BDC. We have space. We've got about 20,000 square feet over in East Baltimore on Haven Street. But that's really exciting. And so that really focuses on our tech entrepreneurs, those companies that are going to scale up, we hope, you know, very, very quickly. And then we also operate, which is relatively new to BDC, although, you know, we've taken it on as a program of the BDC, is our Made in Baltimore program, which works with about 300 different makers in Baltimore City that are making all kinds of different products. So some of it's tech, but a lot of it's low tech, you know, handcrafted food, other products. And so we're very excited to have that under BDC's, you know, auspices as well.
That's great. You guys are doing a lot of things.
We're doing a lot of things, and we've been super busy with COVID. So, you know, we're almost now a year, as everyone, we've been focused on COVID. So we really kind of upended our total operations here at BDC. I'm very fortunate to have, you know, a whole team of, you know, smart, dedicated people. So before COVID, BDC, we didn't do grants. We have one grant program, which is our facade improvement grant. So if you're a small business in one of our commercial areas, and you're looking to, you know, improve the appearance of your small brick and mortar business, we offer a grant for that. That was it. And we do, I don't know, you know, 50, 70 of those, maybe a year. In 2020, we did over 1,000 grants to small businesses.
Wow.
That were COVID related. That's over $13 million of funds that we put out directly in the hands of small businesses. That's almost three times our complete operating budget. So we pretty much created from scratch a small business grant program. And the thing that we didn't do was we didn't do first come, first serve. And we actually waited a little bit before launching our program. I was fortunate enough to be brought into a cohort of cities that Bloomberg Associates and Bloomberg Philanthropies was coordinating. Baltimore's a Bloomberg city, thanks to Michael Bloomberg's relationship with Johns Hopkins. And so, I was kind of seeing what other cities were doing and how they were getting through this, because we were going, how are we going to get all of this money out on the street in very small increments without any infrastructure at all? And people, we were all working remotely, of course, too. I'm the kind of one of two people in the office. And we did it all from scratch. But the thing that we didn't do is we didn't do it first come, first serve. Because we had been focused on equitable and inclusive economic development through our Baltimore Together work, when the crisis hit, when COVID hit, we kind of had this grounding, and we stepped back and we said, what does Baltimore really need to come out of this, or to survive it, first of all, but then hopefully come out stronger? And what we decided was we really need an equitable approach. We need to make sure that these dollars go to small businesses that are typically left out of economic recovery. And for the most part, those are our, you know, Black and brown owned businesses. Those are the businesses in neighborhoods that have been underinvested or disinvested in for years. And so we came up with, you know, a very set, direct, intentional list of criteria that we thought would target those businesses first. And we capped the size of the businesses that could apply. We prioritized businesses owned by people of color. We prioritized certain areas of the city to make sure that they got funds. And we didn't do it first come, first serve. So we opened the window for about 2 weeks and got, you know, literally hundreds of applications. And then each one of those applications was reviewed by a staff person here, essentially ranked in terms of need and priority. And then we awarded the funds, you know, the best that we could based on all of those. And so in the first two rounds of grants, which is the way we set that up, it was hyper local. So 70% of the grants went to businesses owned by city residents, so people that live here and work here. Over 60% went to businesses owned by people of color, black and brown owned businesses, and over 60% went to women owned businesses as well. And so we were very proud of that we were able to do that. It wasn't easy. It was the really hard way to do it, but it was the right way to do it. And actually, you know, we've kind of shared that model with other cities that were, you know, I think trying to achieve a lot of the same things. As we moved on, we did another round of restaurant grants where we actually changed the criteria. So when you look at the statistics, we haven't released them yet, but when we do, they're sort of less diverse. But we did that because at the time, PPP, which was the Payroll Protection Program at the federal level, had run out. And so a lot of these businesses, while they might not be owned by people of color, they're very large employers. And so they employ a lot of people who are either city residents or minority. And so we focus really on kind of securing that employment for our city residents. And so you'll see the numbers kind of skew. Today, we just released another round of restaurant grants. And so we went back to our criteria and we said, well, we want this to make sure that this is as inclusive and equitable as possible. So, you know, we learned our lessons and we adjusted to have some other criteria there so that hopefully we can get more of the restaurant money in particular to black and brown businesses. But again, like that's been, you know, our approach from the very beginning of the recovery. And hopefully that pays off. And so when we come out of COVID, knock on wood, we'll have a more, you know, resilient economy because we've, you know, invested in small businesses, locally owned businesses, businesses owned by people of color, who are really kind of what I see as the future of Baltimore in terms of, you know, attracting more people and growing more jobs.
I love that, Colin. I'm curious, with the whole influx of demand with all these people and their interests, were you already set up and had the proper infrastructure in place, or how did you deal with that?
The short answer is not really. We invented a whole new website, which is BaltimoreTogether.com. We had already had that name as part of our overall strategic planning process, but we hadn't shared it with anybody. And we said, gosh, there's all this information coming out from the feds, from the state, you know, BDC is going to have its programs. It was too cumbersome to put it on our existing website, which already has a ton of information on it. And so we said, we really should set up a separate website that's just dedicated to this COVID thing, which, you know, might be around for a while, because this is back in March, two or three weeks after things had hit. And so we used BaltimoreTogether.com because we had, you know, already purchased it, but we built out the whole website. So that was a new piece of infrastructure that we didn't have. And then I'll give a shout out to a non-Baltimore City business, but it's been great. If you use Airtable, which is a pretty, you know, prominent platform, we had been using Airtable internally, just kind of like manage our own teams. But we were able to do all of the data capture, all the online forms for grants using Airtable, which did not crash at all. And it's been seamless. And we've been able to share internally all the grant information. So of course we've got, you know, our team here is accessing the grants and reviewing them, and everyone can see who's doing what and where we are on it. And I can check in from my phone to see where we are on the grant reviews, and people call and say, did you get my application? I can pull it up and say, yeah. So that's been a godsend, and they were very, they're very helpful with us. We're, as I mentioned, we're a 501c3 organization, nonprofit. And so the fee for Airtable to kind of step up to an enterprise system was pretty minimal. So we probably wouldn't have survived without that technology. And of course, I got to give it up to the team here who figured out how to use it and get it, you know, all up and running. But yeah, that was all invented from scratch. We didn't have any of that back in March. And so there was I think I saw like on LinkedIn or one of these social media sites, it was, you know, who's been leading the tech revolution in your company, you know, your chief operating officer or COVID. It certainly has been COVID. I think it'll be great for the future too, because I think, you know, a lot of the efficiencies that have been gained out of COVID will be around, and we've been able to reach a lot more people through it. We were very concerned, kind of going back to the inclusive part, that we weren't going to be able to reach businesses, especially those who aren't online or hadn't potentially interacted with BDC before. And so doing all of this virtually or online, we were worried we weren't going to reach those businesses. And so we did a survey. The first thing I did, like even before the lockdown began, I issued a survey on social media, and we got, the responses were great. We got 700 responses from small businesses. And we mapped them all on GIS. We're pretty good at mapping here as well. And so we could see where the gaps were, and we could see who hadn't, you know, connected with us. And through that process, with some foundation funding, we ended up, we being BDC, coordinating, which is still working as a technical assistance network. So it's us leading 18 different, or not leading, but coordinating 18 partners, which again is part of Baltimore Together. It's actually a great story, success story that came out of COVID, that we were able to get all these different partners working together for a period of time to serve our small business community. We served over, I think, 1,400 small businesses through that technical assistance network. Eight of the partners are similar to BDC, the kind of small business assistance folks that help you with your PPP or help you with EIDL, which is the SBA's program, or just any other issues you're having. And then the innovative part of it is the other 10 groups are community organizations, and they're all led by people of color. So the Black Arts District, other Main Street programs. And so they were on the ground and could kind of access those businesses that might not have worked with BDC yet. Maybe they were too small, or they weren't familiar with us, or they frankly, you know, didn't think we were the kind of entity that would serve them. And so we were able to reach a lot more businesses, and frankly, a lot more businesses of, you know, owned by people of color that I mentioned. And so I think, you know, like 50% of the network businesses, you know, are owned by Black and Brown business owners. And so that was, you know, one of the things that we want to take moving forward as a best practice and try to expand it beyond just the COVID assistance. But, you know, how do we transition that into, you know, small business loans and credit enhancement and all the other things that small businesses need to survive?
You know, it's unfortunate, obviously, what's happening with COVID, but I feel COVID also sped up a lot of things in many industries, just like what you're telling me. And it's also, I feel it's been the same with what I do with commercial real estate. It just made everything just much more compressed. And you almost have no other choice but to innovate or find other resources and avenues.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched a recent Richard Florida interview that the BBJ did. And then I participated on a panel that I think airs tomorrow. But the Richard Florida's comment was, you know, it's kind of the accelerant, you know. So a lot of the trends that we were seeing before, you know, COVID has just accelerated for better and worse too. So like we already knew that our minority businesses were disadvantaged and typically impacted. Well, when we saw that with COVID, you know, the economic impact of COVID from what, you know, I've seen in the data that we're collecting is like it's not a even economic impact. It's very dynamic, and it's hit, you know, certain industries really hard, like the restaurant hospitality industry, and then it's, you know, helped other industries like, you know, logistics and online purchasing, e-commerce. And so the same thing, you know, is affected, you know, both kind of like demographically, like we've seen it hit our African-American community much harder, not just from a health perspective, which has been true, but then also like as a small business owner, right? They have less access to capital. They have less banking relationships. And so, you know, the sad part about COVID is it's sort of, it's pulled back the curtain, I think, a lot on, you know, inequity that we knew existed, but maybe it was harder to sort of point to. And now, you know, COVID has really you know, shown a light on that. But then in other aspects where, you know, we have a great logistics hub here in Baltimore, we have a company, an ETC company. Unfortunately, they're just over the line in the county, but they obviously employ a lot of city residents, and the CEO is a city resident. It's a company called White Box. They grew out of ETC. They're an e-commerce business, and they just raised, I think, $16 million of venture capital in 2020. And they have, you know, their customers are Amazon and others. And so, you know, they're growing. And then, you know, a lot of the small businesses that are more personal services are getting crushed. And so there's a very uneven economic impact. And what we want to do is make sure that it's not an uneven recovery, right? And again, that sort of goes back to us being very intentional, not being first come, first serve, but really trying to look at the sectors that are getting hit, look at the demographics of who's getting hit, and adjust accordingly. But the other trend that will be interesting to see is, you know, kind of I mentioned companies moving. We had already had several companies move here from California because of the cost of living, because of the talent pool. And, you know, what we're seeing or hearing is, you know, people fleeing, you know, Silicon Valley. Whether that becomes true or not, we'll see. It's certainly not, I don't have any angst against Silicon Valley, but, you know, it would be great for some of the concentrated wealth in our country to be maybe a little bit more distribute it in terms of growth. So hopefully Baltimore can be on the upside of that trend. And I think it's one that COVID has accelerated, as Richard Florida would say.
No, that's so true, Colin. What do you, knowing what you know now, is there anything you wish you would have done differently at the start of your career?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think so. I mean, I'm fairly happy with where I've gotten to. Hindsight's always 20/20, so I know, you know, I've made mistakes along the way. It probably just to be, you know, more ambitious and to, you know, not be so sort of reticent. I'm actually, you know, I typically don't do these types of, you know, interviews, and I'm not the front person. I've never been the front person in my career. Well, I've sort of been, in most cases, behind the mayor or behind the CEO. And I've always enjoyed kind of playing that role. I'm not one to sort of want to jump in front of the camera or be quoted. Now it's my job, so I have to do it. I feel like, you know, I'd be letting my team down if I didn't go on and talk about all the great work that they're doing, because I was in their shoes too. And, you know, it's nice to kind of hear people sing your praises. So, but I probably could have done, you know, more of that earlier in my career and been maybe a little bit less reticent, but no, you know, I've been very fortunate to have great mentors and people look out for me and be able to kind of help me along my path. And you know, a lot of it just goes back to kind of, you know, serving many people, right? You know, it's been said by lots of different people. It's probably said in the Bible or something, although I'm not a scholar, you know, that, you know, how do you become successful? But, by serving many. And so I'm just fortunate enough to have had positions where I get paid to serve and help a lot of people. Working in the public sector, it isn't easy. It's not for everybody. It's very different than the private sector in terms of the stress and what you deal with. But it's also like really awesome to be able to come to the office and like, my job is basically to help other people succeed. That's what BDC is here to help your business succeed in Baltimore. It's to help you grow as a entrepreneur or a business person. And so I think it's very rewarding to be able to do that and to make a career out of it. So I'm not sure if I quite answered your question there. I deviated, but I think it's important to recognize that as well.
No, you definitely did. To wrap things up, Colin, what do you like to do in your free time when you're not busy working?
Yeah, so I have a family, so married to a wonderful wife, and I have a daughter, so they both keep me very busy, and we've got a dog as well, so it's like he's the first baby. So a lot of it's, you know, family time, and I guess my hobby would be running. So I try to get out and run. Not a cold weather fan, so this past week hasn't been great, but But yeah, usually between running, family life, and working, that pretty much fills up the 24 hours.
Yeah, that keeps you busy. If people want to reach out and learn more about you and what you're doing there at the BDC, what's a good resource or websites they can find out some more information and all the different programs you offer?
Yeah, so in terms of websites, the Baltimore Development Corporation's website is baltimoredevelopment.com. So you certainly go there and learn about all the different economic development programs that we offer. Excuse me. And then in terms of COVID and also our strategic plan, Baltimore Together, that's baltimoretogether.com. You can sign up for updates and information or ask any questions through that website that you have related to that. And then if you want to reach out to me, I'm on LinkedIn. You can, you know, find me there pretty easily. And then my email is ctarbert@baltimoredevelopment.com. If you want to email me directly, I do get lots of emails, but pretty good at responding. So.
Fantastic. Colin, again, thank you so much for coming on. I greatly appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and stay healthy, stay well, and look forward to connecting in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Same. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
If you haven't done so already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and leave a review and comment and let me know what you think. Thank you, and I'll see you all very soon on the next episode.